rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfield, Judge Jessen, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Judge Diane Bradfield, presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. So for the record, this is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and we are on September 18th, 2019. And today's panel has already been announced by the marshal. We have the lawyers sitting at council table today, and so I will ask the marshal to call the first case, and then I will make just a few remarks.
Case 819-0233, First Baptist Church of St. Paul et al. Appellants, Church of St. Pascal Balin et al. Plaintiffs versus City of St. Paul respondents.
All right, and so just a couple things for council. I'm sure you're familiar with our procedures and have been here before, but just to remind you, so you take some time, settle yourselves in as you get to the podium and make whatever adjustments to the microphone. We do record proceedings today, so it's helpful for us if you speak into the microphone, we can hear you better, and then we have that record. In addition, make sure you announce who you are and who you represent before you start your remarks, and please keep an eye on the clock. The time does tend to move quickly. We really do look forward to our conversation with you today. So, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jack Heschler. I am here representing the plaintiffs in this matter. And it is noteworthy that these cases have been going on for the last 8 years. And so, with your leave, I'd like to give you a little information about the setting of the two important issues that are intersecting in this case. The point is, I have been challenging on behalf of various plaintiffs since 2011 the City of St. Paul's Street Right-of-Way Assessment Program. The Street Right-of-Way Assessment Program was St. Paul's effort, unique among Minnesota cities, to shift more than $32 million worth of annual operating costs in their Public Works Department from regular taxation to the special assessment modality. This allowed the city officials to claim that they were holding the line on their taxes because the special assessments show up below the line on your tax statement. And even though the special assessments were rising at a compounded 6% a year rate, nevertheless, from a political point of view, because a lot of people don't understand assessments and all of this sort of thing, the elected officials could say, we're watching you, we're taking care of you. This case culminated, these cases, because we had to bring a case each year, these cases culminated in a unanimous decision in 2016, the summer of 2016, by the Minnesota Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court ruled that the city was simply wrong, that it had no basis for collecting a fee like this, and if it was going to collect a special assessment, it had to follow the rules with respect to special assessments, and more specifically, had to show that the special assessment caused a special benefit, an increase in price, or an increase in value to the property that was being charged. Notwithstanding this unanimous decision in the summer of 2016.
Before you leave that decision, just let me make sure I understand, because I was a little confused based on the argument in your brief. The Supreme Court in the 2016 decision did remand for a determination.
It did.
Right?
It did. Okay. It said that the city's fee argument, the city had originally said that they were doing this as a special assessment. We challenged that, presided professional testimony that there was no special benefit. The city could not find an assessor that would, or an appraiser that would agree with them, and so they changed their theory to no, it's not a special assessment. It's really a regulatory fee. And so the issue that went up to the Supreme Court was, could they charge a regulatory fee like a parking
ticket? Right, and that issue is not in front of us.
But that issue is not in front of us. The law is rather clear that they must follow the tax law rules, and they must show a special benefit. And so in this case, the problem is that the City of St. Paul has never attempted to show a special benefit and has never been able to show special benefit for its citywide special assessment program. But
and I understand that's your position. It's well articulated in your brief. I guess what I'm hoping that you will get to, and I don't mean to push you in that direction if you have more preliminary remarks, but it seems to me, you know, that the district court had one very basic reason for rejecting your appeal from the assessment.
That is correct.
Okay. And that primary or first reason had to do with timeliness of the appeal itself.
That is correct.
And you are not challenging timeliness.
We are not challenging timeliness at all. Right. We are admitting that these plaintiffs have fallen victim to the briar patch of protections that the city has around its special assessment procedure. This procedure is protected by the world's shortest statute of limitations. And I'll repeat that again, the world's shortest statute of limitations, zero. The plaintiffs may not bring a claim unless they have provided written objection to the city before the city even adopts the assessment.
How I read the special assessment. Isn't it time based on the city's adoption of the assessment?
Yes, under 421, it is you must file a notice of objection before the city adopts the ordinance. And then in 081, you have to file within 30 days thereafter.
Right, and it's that second part that the district court focused on, as I read the district court's
opinion. Yes, the city
didn't. And you aren't challenging, so I'm just hesitating to fall into that detailed discussion about the filing of the notice of appeal of the special tax assessment because that's not your issue on appeal,
that
right?
That is correct. Issue
you're just
is
setting that aside.
We admit we don't have a state cause of action. We have not complied with the notice of claim rules. We contend that we have a separate and independent federal cause of action, and that's why this case is important.
And this is your takings claim? You are asserting you have a separate and independent takings claim?
Yes.
Under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments?
Yes.
Through via Section 1983 action, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the primary argument I see that I really do want to understand your position on is your opponent says, and it appears to me to be true in the record, that claim, the takings claim, was not a basis for your appeal of the tax special assessment. In other words, it wasn't included in your notice of appeal to the district court.
Well, we have been contending this all the way through, and the plaintiffs were really contending that it was not in our notice of appeal.
It was in our notice of appeal to the district court.
But
I'm
in the district court,
be clear.
They have said that we didn't plead it properly. And
I've seen several cases from this court have analyzed a notice of appeal in a tax in a special assessment case as being similar to a complaint.
Yes.
And it does proceed very much.
Indeed,
like
I called this an appeal or a complaint.
Right.
In my actual pleadings, but my point is that this is a notice pleading statement. We need not to include in our appeal or in our complaint all of the legal theories and or case law that might be appropriate to a subsequent argument. All we have to do is provide notice of a claim and the facts that give rise to the claim.
I think you're stating Minnesota law accurately on that.
We are
a notice pleading state, but you have to give notice. So what language would you point to in your, you know, we'll call it a pleading to the district court in this special assessment appeal, what language would you point to? Because I didn't see that in your briefing, and it's obviously the primary argument we're hearing from your opponent. I don't mean to derail your presentation. You can always address this in your rebuttal as well.
In fact, let me do that if you want.
Okay, I do not mind at all.
Language. My presentation is basically that I would cite Heron Haddock on the civil rules, that all that is necessary for a claim to be stated sufficiently is for the pleading to give notice of the claim and to contain a reference to the occurrence or transaction with enough particularity to permit application of the doctrine of res judicata. In other words, there is no in hac verba pleading requirement here. There is no special words that have to be used, and particularly in the context of an assessment appeal. Assessment appeals are by their nature sort of sui generis, and there is no accepted form, but they...
Well, it's interesting because the procedural history here is that you actually did prepare and file a motion to amend your district court.
Pleading. Yes, to add...
To add a takings claim.
No, well, to add a 1983 claim.
Right, 1983.
Not a takings claim. We always had a takings claim.
You have to assert that through 1983, don't you?
No, I don't.
Okay,
And indeed, that's an important issue here. 1983 is a remedy, is a federal remedy for the violation of a constitutional right. It itself is not the cause of action. It gives you a right to attorney's fees and damages, but you are asserting in a 1983 action a violation of your constitutional rights, our Fifth and 14th Amendment actions.
You make a valid point, but I just want to make sure, again, that I hear your voice on the issue, which is it's by making this motion to amend your district court pleading, it suggests to me that perhaps it was missing in the initial pleading.
And what was missing was the request for attorney's fees.
Well, I assume address it in rebuttal, but I do not see an assertion of this takings claim in your pleading to the district court.
In my pleadings, I believe that I said that this was unconstitutional, that the action of the city was unconstitutional, a violation of the Constitution. I said it was a violation of Minnesota law. The federal Constitution is an element of Minnesota law. The fact that I did not say that it was a violation of the 14th Amendment should not be fatal to my pleading. My pleading was attempted to, my pleading did attempt to set forth clearly the facts surrounding this case, the facts that there was no special benefit, and the facts that this matter was not, as I said, had been already decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court. The first group of plaintiffs that we had here have been, in fact, refunded more than $400,000 as a result of their claim. The second group had this technical problem with respect to this to the notice of claim rules, and that's why it's important to understand that under the federal law, under Felder v. Casey, the United States Supreme Court case that arose out of Wisconsin, and that was a case in 1988, the United States Supreme Court said, notwithstanding how fair, uniform, longstanding, non-discriminatory state rules of notice of claim, notwithstanding that, there are no such rules in the federal statute. And so when a claim is made for a remedy under the 14th and the Fifth Amendment here, incidentally, that was a Fourth Amendment and 14th Amendment case. But the point is, it's the same doctrine that the notice state cannot inhibit or restrict a claim by insertion of these notice of claim rules. And that was exactly the same thing that happened to Felder. Brought his claim in Wisconsin for being roughed up by the Milwaukee police 9 months after the problem arose.
If I may, Mr. Hushler, how is the case before us different than the Bosch versus City of Pine Island case, which was decided by a different panel of this court earlier this year? Or is it the same and you're just saying it's an unpublished case?
It is the same arguments, except that in the Bosch case, there the predicate issue was failure to personally serve the city with the complaint in the first instance. And so those facts are a little different and are meaningful, I think. And that's one reason we did not appeal the Bosch case, because we felt that the failure to personally serve the complaint, even though it was by mistake, and even though the city laid in the weeds and did not respond to a letter stating that understanding. We felt that that, two things we felt. One, the plaintiffs there could not afford to proceed further, and we also thought that it had distinguishing facts that it wasn't
distinguishing facts, but that wasn't the basis that this a panel of this court said that the preemption claim was not properly before us. That was based on, wasn't it, the, kind of the same facts that the issue wasn't raised until the response to the city's motion to dismiss?
No, well, the issue, the main fact in that case was that we mistook a statement by the city clerk, by the city manager, and sent the complaint by email rather than personally serving it. And the court basically said, that's jurisdictional, you're out of luck. So it was a different set of facts in that. I think that there is an important difference there. So in this case, there is a clear statement of the fact that we have this freestanding cause of action, and it cannot be trammeled or inhibited by the state notice of claim rules under Felder v. Casey, and that's the basic position that we have. So in this general statement is that we admit no state cause of action, but if you look at those Minnesota cases, not only Minnesota, but also with federal cases, Norwood versus Baker, the U.S. Supreme Court case in 1898, says freestanding cause of action without, you must have a special benefit. Then in Minnesota, Quality Homes, Carlson Lang, Buettner, all of these cases state the general proposition that, to quote Buettner, therefore this court has established the rule that a special assessment which exceeds the special benefits to the property, measured by the difference in market value before and after the improvements, is a taking of property without fair compensation in violation of the 14th Amendment. So it's very important to note that Minnesota has for years noted the separate freestanding nature of the federal claim. However, usually it's not necessary to say anything more than that, because usually the cases do not have notice of claim problems associated with them. They have, in fact, either given up because they missed the filing dates, or secondly, they've already met all of those requirements. And so when the court has ruled on behalf of the plaintiffs in those cases and said this is a violation of the 14th Amendment, it was also a violation of the state constitution. And so nobody's paid a lot of attention. Now, this is the first case that brings this intersection of a pure federal cause of action with the Felder v. Casey requirements that says you can determine that, and that my pleadings were, I ask you to review my pleadings and I'll look in rebuttal, my pleadings were sufficient to give the city notice that we were objecting to these special assessments, we were objecting on the grounds that there was no special benefit, and that we didn't have to say violation of more than the Constitution and the law.
And Council, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Megan Hafner. I'm here today on behalf of Respondent City of St. Paul. This case presents an unusual appeal to this court in that appellants are seeking to have remanded to the district court, back to the district court, a cause of action that was never asserted in their initial assessment appeal, and the district court did not decide. They state that the issue in this case is solely whether or not they have a separate, independent federal U.S. constitutional claim that survives the district court's dismissal. It's fault. Their arguments are.
Is that limited to state court, or could they still have a federal court claim?
The city's position is that the claims that were asserted under Minnesota Constitution and pursuant to 429. Are dismissed, and those cannot be asserted again. Whether or not the appellants have a separate, independent federal cause of action was not decided, was not before the district court in that sense. And so whether or not a federal court has jurisdiction or things like that, that is not the issue before this court.
But Judge Kirk's question, you know, implies that based on your position in the appeal, that our appellants have not asserted their federal takings claim, that it might still be available. I was going to ask the question a little differently because this is a dismissal without prejudice.
Correct. This is a dismissal without prejudice.
Now, I realize your position on the 429 arguments, that wouldn't matter because of the timeliness issue, the lack of subject matter jurisdiction. But as to the federal takings claim, which is the only one they're talking about in court today,
well,
I'm just wondering if it's a dismissal without prejudice, don't they have the option of seeking it?
They may have the option of seeking.
They may have defenses.
They can assert any claim that was not dismissed by the district court because that was without prejudice, and the city would defend on various grounds depending on what claim they actually asserted and what constitutional claim they asserted.
And I am just talking about that federal takings claim because that's the only argument that they're raising in our court today. So if with a dismissal without prejudice and with your position being that the district court didn't even consider a federal takings claim, right, because it wasn't asserted, doesn't
Correct.
That mean that that claim is out there potentially to be reasserted?
Yes, Your Honor.
By the appellants.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. However, I would say that the appellants, the only time they even raised a constitutional issue was in the opposition to the city's motion to dismiss. And in that, it was clear that the constitutional claim that they were alleging in that case had to do with the constitutionality of Section 429 and the process of written objection under 429.061, which in this case, the appellants did not serve a written objection pursuant to 429.061. They also did not serve and file their assessment appeal within the time frame under 429.081.
Well, if I read their opposition differently, and in fact they did assert in their memorandum a constitutional challenge along the lines of Felder and the preemption argument that they're making for their federal takings claim, I mean, I think that still leads me to ask, is that sufficient to have asserted a federal takings claim in front of this district court judge? In other words, would we have to remand for consideration of the federal takings claim?
No, Your Honor, you would not need to.
Because we don't have a ruling from our district.
The district court did not decide that issue. That was not asserted in their notice of assessment appeal. And I think also the court should be mindful of the 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment and the various clauses in those amendments and what the appellants attempted to assert in their memo in opposition. They asserted a 14th Amendment due process claim related to the notice provisions in 429.061. That is different than a takings claim under the Fifth Amendment. And this is giving much more credence to anything that was actually done in this case because none of this was cited in their notice of appeal. And although Minnesota has notice pleadings rules, what occurred in this case does not even meet those very liberal standards. They've conceded that it's untimely and that it's undisputed that they only referenced Minnesota Statute 429 and the Minnesota Constitution. We cite it in our brief, and it's on page 4, I believe, of the Notice of Appeal. They only cite to 429 and the Minnesota Constitution. And this case is very similar. As to the separate federal constitutional claim, it's the same as the Bosch case that was recently decided by another panel earlier this year.
Well, it's the same in some respects, but that was a case where there was failure of service, which raises a personal jurisdiction issue.
Correct. Right. As to just the separate federal cause of action not alleged, that argument, it's the same as Bosch. In Bosch and in other cases in this court, such as Carlson Lang and the Buettner case, in there they talk about one aspect of the special assessment under 429 the determination of whether or not the assessment exceeds a special benefit is in effect the determining the due process of under claim under 14 or under the 14th Amendment, the Minnesota Constitution, and the 14th Amendment. So as far as a separate claim, they did not allege it. And that dismisses, I think that dismisses the appeal at this point for this court.
So, counsel, wouldn't you agree when we're trying to assess what's adequate notice provided in the complaint, we ought to look at that in light of the time to appeal, which is, you know, as appellant's counsel pointed out, really short in this setting. I think I'm alluding to it as the victim of the briar patch of protections.
So what I would say to that, Your Honor, is that that is a claim that is the one claim that they did raise in their motion to in opposition to the city's motion to dismiss, which is the Minnesota Statute 429 and those notice of claim rules under 061. That's a claim that those are unconstitutional. And they have relinquished in their brief, they say that they're relinquished to claim that those timeframes are unconstitutional.
But conceptually, wouldn't you agree if we're going to say, well, is it adequate notice of this constitutional claims, you know, and look at that broadly and liberally as we're supposed to, shouldn't we, as part of that, what's adequate in a context where there's very little time to appeal might not be adequate where, you know, it's a 6-year statute of limitations.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I guess it depends on if you're talking about the notice to appeal the adoption of the assessment or the notice of appeal to this court and what they need to raise to the district court once it switches to a judicial proceeding. And there are several procedures that are in place before the adoption of the assessment that gets adopted, and the statute and those timeframes are significant. It's not just 30 days. And that has been in the law in Minnesota for a very long time. There is significant law talking about special assessments and why the importance of having finality to that and not having a separate federal cause of action where a party could wait, not do any assessment appeal, and 5 or 6 years later object to a special assessment. That goes against all of 429, and the appellants have not cited any authority for such a proposition as that. And also, as to the Felder and preemption issue, it's clear that the district court did not address that issue and decide that issue. The court, because the arguments were focused on the constitutionality of Section 429.061, so, and the appellants incorrectly sort of group 429.061 and 429.081 together and say that these are notice of claim rules that are preempted. Preemption doesn't apply in this case because there's three ways you get preemption, which is express preemption, which we don't have, or field preemption, where the federal court completely occupies the area. We don't have that. Minnesota Statute 429 specifically says it's the exclusive method to challenge a special benefit. And also there's the Sievert case cited in our brief, which talks about all claims need to be asserted at the 429. And there really isn't a conflict preemption claim here either. Felder had to do with a notice of claim rule saying that anytime you sue the state or the city, you need to provide notice within 120 days of the cause of action or that it arises, your injury. Minnesota has a similar notice of claim, but that's not at issue here. That's what this is.
I think counsel's reasoning by analogy. He's not suggesting that he is asserting the same claim as was asserted in Felder.
Right, but it's not that the 429.081 is the similar as 429.061, which has to do with the written objection and that the failure to file that, which the appellants did not do in this case either. But because the 429.081 was a complete dismissal, that is, whereas in the McCullough case, that appellants rely on, the court decided to remand the constitutional issues about whether or not requiring it to be in writing and whether or not if those were constitutional and those notice time provisions were constitutional, those were the claims that were remanded.
So I wanted to ask you a slightly different question about the preemption issue, and I'm trying to recall, which I read in your brief as opposed to the Bausch case. I just read the Bausch case again. So that case, this court analyzed the preemption issue to say that it was not in front of the court because, in that case, again, the appellants had not asserted it below until their memorandum in opposition, which I think parallels the scenario here. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly the same as our case.
All right. And so I just want to have your take on this. You know, preemption isn't typically viewed, in my understanding, but correct me if I'm wrong, as a claim. You don't make a claim like a cause of action, right? It's an argument you make about why law is governed by why federal law governs or state law governs or something along those lines.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm just trying to, when would they have raised it? You know, it wouldn't be a count in their notice of appeal of the special assessment.
Well, part of the Bausch case and our case and the preemption argument is that the appellants have the burden to show preemption and how that applies, how that interplays with 429.
Your argument is just preemption doesn't apply. I get that. I just want to get your take on when it would have been asserted properly by these appellants.
It would have been asserted when in their notice of assessment appeal if they had stated a separate federal cause of action, and then it would have been an issue before the court to decide. So I would say that Bausch was sort of two reasons in that they didn't assert it until the motion in opposition, but also it was not analyzed or thoroughly argued, and so this court could not decide those issues. In the Thiel case, there's discussion of this court considers what the district court decided and remanded, or decided and dismissed. So the city's position is straightforward. None of the claims asserted by the appellants in their assessment appeal survived the city's motion to the district court for dismissal. Appellants concede that the district court properly dismissed their assessment appeals pursuant to 429 because they were untimely. They've also affirmatively relinquished any claims that 429 and their constitutional claims that they did assert in the motion to in opposition, they've affirmatively relinquished those and said that after reconsideration, they now claim it's preemption, which they're not allowed to rethink their arguments after the district court dismisses. Because these were the only two issues asserted in the district court and the only issues decided by the district court, that court decision should be affirmed and this appeal should be dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Preliminarily, I just want to say that I made a copy of my initial brief, but I didn't make a copy of the appendix. So unfortunately, I don't have the complaint. But I point out three things, that the state statute says that you can appeal, your only grounds for appeal in these matters is that there was a mistake of fact or law or there's no special benefit. And my complaint, I suggest, makes clear that there was a mistake of both fact and law, not in any particular words, but it's quite clear that what I am driving at. And the city has contended in other cases that I was required to state within the 3 minutes that the city council gave us to object to these assessments, I was required to not only put in all of my evidence, but to state all of my theories. And if I fail to do that, I should be out of luck. Well, this is this briar patch of procedural monkey business that the city relies upon and has relied upon it for years. And that's what has discouraged so many people from bringing valid claims. I can tell you that it's a miracle that 21 parish priests got organized within 30 days to do this matter. It's not the sort of thing, talk about herding cats, just to have them understand what their claim is and their cause of action is not an insignificant effort. So the point simply is that if there is to be true justice to the citizens in a case like this, there needs to be an opportunity to make these arguments, not in the very first instance, as Justice says, Justice Bradfield says, but rather, in this case, these arguments were made in the very first hearing that came up. Pleadings were exchanged, and then the first motion was the city's motion to dismiss. And that's when Felder v. Casey was argued at length. The trial court decided that because it decided it didn't have any jurisdiction under the notice of claim rules, that it didn't get to Felder issues. Well, I think that is just simply incorrect. And at the very least, the court has pointed out that this was a dismissal without prejudice. At the very least, this matter ought to be sent back, and the district court ought to be told to review on the merits the federal claim that we have. And secondly, ought to review on the merits the Felder case. And if that happens, that would be substantial justice. More justice would be if this court ruled on the merits that I have in fact pleaded with enough particularity to give the city honest notice. I have in fact argued with enough particularity and early enough, that is to say at the very first hearing, that Felder was the important case in this matter. I have in fact pleaded throughout that there was no special benefit here and that the city hasn't been able to show one. And in fact, the city has not. And that's why they paid off more than $400,000 worth of claims to the first group of plaintiffs in this case. The city has relied on this thicket of procedural rules, and you could hear counsel today talking about all of the things that we didn't do, should have done, and this is making a mockery of substantial justice. The issue is, has this issue been put fairly before the court, before the city? And the answer is yes. And secondly, the issue is this 14th Amendment claim of the plaintiffs in fact a freestanding claim, or does it rely, does it have to be made through the state court? And the answer is, to answer counsel, the court's question, within the last 2 months, the United States Supreme Court has come down with a Knick opinion that clarified that it is no longer necessary to pursue a constitutional claim in state court first before you bring it in federal court in a case like this. And so the answer is, when this case was filed, the jurisprudence was such that it seemed clear that you had to pursue your constitutional claim through the state court system. These are coextensive and coordinate. The district court in each case, the state district court has subject matter jurisdiction over this claim. And the fact that, here's where another thing I think the court erred, the fact that we did not file or did not meet the notice of claim rules does not deprive the court of subject matter jurisdiction. This is a court of general jurisdiction, and the subject matter jurisdiction cannot be affected by the action of the parties. The court either has jurisdiction or it doesn't. In this case, it has jurisdiction. It had personal jurisdiction over the city, and this was pleaded with enough particularity. Indeed, my complaint was not notice pleading. My complaint went on for 5 or 6 pages. I can't remember how many, but the point simply is multiple paragraphs, and that ought to be enough.
Stop, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. The matter was well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.